Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, the CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, I talk with Christine Carter. Christine Carter, PhD, is the author of best-selling books, The Sweet Spot, How to Achieve More by Doing Less, and Raising Happiness. A sought-after keynote speaker and coach, Dr. Carter writes an award-winning blog, Brave Over Perfect. She is a sociologist and senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, where she draws on scientific research to help people lead their most meaningful, joyful, and authentic lives. And now, Christine Carter. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Good to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
In the workplace today, you almost ask anybody how they're doing, and the answer is going to be, I'm so busy. And we wear it almost as a badge of honor, it seems.
Yeah.
What would you say about that?
Yeah. Proclaiming how busy we are is definitely a humble brag. It comes from this myth, really, this idea that busyness can be equated with productivity, with significance, with importance. We live in this world where it seems like the most impressive people have the most to do, that they're most pressed for time. And so it's just sort of become this cultural mantra when people are looking at us, especially, I think, in the workplace. We make claims to our own value based on busyness. Now, of course, it's not true. Busyness cannot be equated with productivity or significance or importance, but we behave as though it is true.
Yeah. And what are some of the downsides for that kind of always on busy, busy, busy life and just kind of buying the myth, if you will?
Yeah. Well, not questioning the myth has huge repercussions because it does keep us all the way on all the time. So if busyness is a sign of importance, then the reverse must also be true, which is when we are not busy, when we're taking some downtime, we must not have any value. We must not be very significant. And so anything that could be categorized as rest suddenly becomes undervalued and seen as unnecessary. And there are huge repercussions to always being on all the time.
Yeah.
Which I can go into.
Yeah. Well, I think it'd be great because let's start to debunk this myth of more busy is better.
Yeah.
Because so many of us are in that space that people that may be listening to this are saying, well, yeah, I am that way. And it just has continued year after year. I've yet to hear anyone tell me how to do it differently.
Yeah.
I know it's probably not that good for me because I can feel it taking a toll on my body and my relationships and all of this sort and my productivity.
Yeah.
But what's the way out of this?
Yeah. So it's not good for us at all. It's not good for our brains. It's not good for our productivity. You're right. It's not good for our relationships. A lot of things happen when we try and keep ourselves doing things all the time. So from a brain perspective, first of all, we know that the brain becomes less and less efficient the longer it's on. The brain needs to cycle back and forth between periods of intense focus and periods of relaxed inattention. So we tend to think that if we're not doing something all the time, then nothing must be happening in this big brain of ours. But in fact, when we look at fMRI scans of brains, when somebody is just staring into space or their mind is wandering, what we see is that the brain is actually a lot more active than it is if you're just focusing on solving an analytical problem or focusing on anything. So what's happening when we're just daydreaming or we're just staring into space, when we're not busy, is that the brain is drawing connections between things that it didn't previously see as connected. And it's actually forming lots of neural connections, which then become a part of our intelligence. And those connections are the seat of all creativity and innovation. So if you have a job which requires that you come up with a novel solution to a problem or any problem solving whatsoever, anything requiring any sort of innovation, we need that consolidation time. Of course, a lot of other things are also happening. The brain is writing things into memory and just basically doing a little bit of cleanup. So it's very active. It's very important. It's not as though we can go without that time. And when we try and push our brain to behave other than it naturally wants to by pushing it to focus all the time, which doesn't actually feel like focus to us, so we can talk about that too. But when we're always doing something and we're not letting ourselves relax into sort of a daydreamy state, the first thing that we see is that our creativity takes a hit. The second thing is that we become really, really exhausted because it's just very hard for the brain starts to take more and more oxygen and more glucose to run the longer you push it to do something that it doesn't naturally want to do.
That all sounds right. And the question that comes to mind is, what do we do about it, especially at work? I mean, we might have time where we can finally put the kids to bed or get our time back at home where we have just 45 minutes to ourselves or whatever it is before we go to bed, which is our time. But how do we make that happen throughout the day, throughout work?
Yeah. So I'm going to back up a little bit and say the first thing that we need to do in solving this problem, because the obvious solution is take breaks, stare into space, daydream a little bit more.
Well, awkward but, at work sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Oh, just staring into space.
Right, right, right. And people are like, okay, lady, can you give us a tip that I'll actually use, right? Like, I'm not going to just go back to daydreaming while at work, right? So what we need to do is back up a little bit and look at our understanding of why we resist so much. And we've talked about that a little bit, but I think it also helps to understand that this sort of busyness equals importance is a holdover from industrialization, in which our time really became equated with our productivity and then money and then our value. And so we have this really deep-seated urge to always be producing all the time, because of a really outdated cultural paradigm, right? Our whole sense of time and everything came during industrialization. And so if we can kind of go back and look at what actually does create value in our work, what is it that we do that brings the greatest value to our careers and our companies or whatever the case may be? And that, of course, is usually innovation, problem solving. Most people these days are being paid to think in one way or another. And so we need to take care of ourselves in such a way that we fulfill our potential, not just for productivity, but also for intelligence and creativity. And by the way, the good news is that joy also tends to come from this. So I like to ask people to think about that and to know that the way to fulfill your potential is not to try and be on all the time, but to think about constantly trading off back and forth between kind of an open awareness, daydreamy state, and a more focused state. And I like people to think about themselves as giving themselves regular intervals during the day to slack off strategically. I like to think about strategic slacking, because they're really are times during our day in which it is much more strategic to just be daydreaming than it is to be doing what we compulsively do now, which is checking our email or checking our smartphones in some way for some sort of information feed, any form of stimulation. So we don't just wait in line anymore. We wait in line while we are also checking things on our phone. And that makes us feel busy. It creates a sense of urgency, especially if we're checking an email and then now suddenly there's something to do. This makes us feel really important. It also is hindering us in a lot of different ways, right? The busier we stay, the longer we go without a break, the less able we are to prioritize, to plan our time, to manage our time. So ironic, right? We start to feel more and more overwhelmed. And all of that overwhelm really does hinder our ability to do things like problem solve or even relate to other people on our team.
You know, this concept of when you're looking at your life and trying to create more of a balanced life of big gears and little gears.
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell us a little more about how that relates to what we're talking about?
Yeah, I got this from my friend Monique Devane, who taught me, she was a mentor, and when I was younger, she taught me that to look at life as a set of interlocking gears. And there are big gears and there are small gears. And when we want to make changes in our lives, we tend to look at the big gears. You know, I would be happier if I got married or had a baby, or I'd be more successful if I changed jobs or moved to Chicago. But what I've found actually in my work as an executive coach and a sociologist, that people actually can use the small gears and their whole life can shift, right? So you can shift these tiny little gears. So this is an example of a tiny little gear, right? If you know that every day at lunch, you go and wait in line to get your salad, and you spend that 10 minutes looking at your phone, making a shift using that 10 minutes to just stare into space can dramatically shift the work that you do after lunch. So that's an example of like tiny little change that then can have a cascading effect.
Mm-hmm. Are there other things that you suggest for people that are going to start making these small changes in their lives that start to add up over time, and other ways to look at these small gears and start to make adjustments?
Well, I think that what our culture loves is big change and drama. And what we know is that that's not really the way human beings make lasting change. It's true, you know, health crises will create a big shift. And, you know, any sort of crisis can help us make big changes. But for normal people who really want to make changes, the best way to do it is to make barely perceptible changes, right? To take tiny little steps, because the human organism is very habitual, mm-hmm. and it will tend to resist. We tend to resist unconsciously change because it just keeps us in our familiar patterns. This is very evolutionarily adaptable in some circumstances to find comfort in our habits. So what we want to do, if we want to change our habits, is change them so slowly that our unconscious doesn't resist it, right? And mm-hmm. so that we don't set ourselves up to have these spectacular failures in which we've had an amazing week and a half doing the new behavior, and then, you know, finally your willpower just caves. So if you can just make small, small, small steps. So maybe if we're talking about taking more breaks during the day, really 1 minute. One day, and then 4 days later, 2 minutes. There's a little bit of evidence that just incrementally inching things up every 4 days is the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that are in the workplace also have kids and families and a full mm-hmm. life there. And that presents a special challenge all the way around because we're already really busy at work. And now we have all this balance. And I know you've been a working mother for some time, and I'm curious, you know, what do you think about those folks that are trying to do it all, if you will, and feeling overwhelmed in both their work life, but then also in their family life? How do you help people kind of strike a balance there? How do they start to even orient around getting a balance in those two quadrants and knowing that oftentimes they're really combined and intermeshing?
Yeah, well, it is true. I have four teenagers, and this is one of those areas of my life that is always iterative. You know, as people who have kids know, their needs change every year as well. So it can be a really moving target. So not only do our careers evolve over their lifespan, but the amount of time and the type of effort that we put into our parenting tends to change almost every year. And so this is the way to look at it, that this is always iterative, that what we're doing is striving to do our best at work and at home, but that perfection is never attainable. It's not even the goal, that it's just iterative. If every week we can make a shift that makes things a little bit easier for us, yay. I often find in myself and the people I work with, it's really really important not to compare our actual real life lives, reality, to our fantasies about how we think things should be. And anytime I notice that I am shooting on myself, thinking like, oh, I should be picking my kids up from school. Why am I the only mom who's making them take the bus, even though it takes them an hour and a half, right? So that sort of shooting behavior is a signal to me that I'm out of integrity and that I have learned at this point, my youngest is 14. I've been doing this for a little while. My instincts are really pretty good. I can trust myself. And so if I can take time to reflect and say, okay, is this the best solution for our family? And the best solution is always the lowest stress solution. And if outside forces are making me feel like maybe it's not the best solution, I can let that be other people's business.
What would you say are other ways that we can cultivate life-work balance?
I love to think about minimum effective dose, finding the minimum effective dose of every activity in our lives. And this goes for both at work and at home. So of course, the minimum effective dose is something that doctors use. They just want to prescribe the minimum amount of any given medication for their patients that will work, that will be effective. That's the key thing here. You know, we live in such a more is more kind of a culture that we often forget that sometimes more is toxic, right? If this were with medication, we would absolutely understand that more is not necessarily better. And the same thing is absolutely true of our lives. Every little activity that we have, we can see that certain things, like we just have this assumption that more would be better. So I went through and found the minimum effective dose for basically everything in my life that was starting to feel like a burden. So you never want to do this with the things that are bringing you lots of joy. So for example, I love reading and catching up on the literature, and I could probably get away with reading less, but I wouldn't want to do that. That just sucks the joy out of my life. But there were lots of things, you know, how much time I was spending on email, for example. It just sort of inches up and takes over your life, right? It was like all day at work. And then when I would get home, I would feel like I would need to check in as well. And also, you know, while you're sort of waiting anywhere, it can take over. So I like people to really experiment with how little they can get away with and be more effective. Now, with email, there is a ton of evidence that more is not better and that less can actually be more. The people who are checking their email upwards of 25 times a day do better when they limit it to just 3 times a day because they're less reactive, they're more thoughtful in their responses. And this is particularly true of managers who are then modeling this behavior for lots of their direct reports. So for me, I had to do it to failure, right? So I was only checking my email 20 minutes a day, 4 days a week. And that did not work. Right? But I found that I could actually not check email, not check my work email 3 days out of 7. So not on the weekends. And one other day, I could just give it up altogether. And that I could just check it twice a day for 20 minutes apiece. And it was a total game changer for me. Now, I have done this with meetings, the amount of time I spend coaching or just on the phone. Every work activity I have, I've sort of given it a week's worth of my time analysis to figure out how little I can do it. And I did it at home as well. So when I went into this minimum effective dose experiment, I was under the impression that I needed to be helping each of my children with their homework. And they were younger than they are now, and they were definitely at a period of time in their life when they needed help with homework and that sort of external structure. Turns out they loved not having my help, loved it. It improved everything for us. So I just do a little check-in, but I don't actually help them.
So when we think about stress in the workplace, stress and work oftentimes are intermeshed and kind of go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And we all know that stress in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen this rise of the conversation around building resilience. Mm-hmm. How do you think about resilience?
I think it's really important to have some practical strategies in your pocket for when things are stressful, when life is difficult, when things seem really uncertain. I don't think regular people in their everyday lives think, how can I be more resilient today? Yeah.
And drowning in some cases.
Right.
And so, yeah, this whole concept of what do you have in your back pocket is really important at that point.
Right. We know, you know, as researchers that people need to have strategies that will make them more resilient. But when you most need those strategies, you're not going to come up with them, right? You're not even going to have time to listen to a podcast like this to do it. And so obviously the best medicine is preventative, right? So when we're talking about everyday stressors, for most people today in the United States, they're under a lot of low-ish level, but chronic stress. Mm. And what we know about chronic stress, even if it's pretty low level, is that it's extremely damaging to our bodies and to our brains and our overall well-being over time. And so to me, resilience is really about finding ways to stop and notice that actually you're pretty anxious, or the way your life is set up is causing you regular stress every single day, and taking some time to actually recover from that. So that's not like a super practical everyday strategy. I will give you those. But I do think that when we're looking at this, the first thing to do is to build an awareness of what's causing stressors in our lives, and then do everything within our power to prevent them. You know, I just think most of us accept that life is stressful. And in fact, that's a terrible thing to just accept about your life. Now, ironically, acceptance is one of my core sort of back pocket strategies for when things are really difficult or uncertain or stressful. What I want is for people to not resist in the moment. So there's a really big difference between accepting what's happening for you in a given moment and accepting negative things in your life. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah, because you're looking at the overall system. If stress is a constant companion, then you want to look at the overall picture. But when you're in a stressful moment, one of the biggest things you can do is just accept it for the moment and not resist it.
Yes, yes. And this is so counterintuitive when I just talk to people about, okay, so yes, this horrible thing is happening right now, or this terribly stressful thing, or you have all of this uncertainty around X. What we need to do right now is just take a minute to breathe and to accept the circumstances that are right now. So it's raining and you want it to be sunny. Please don't go outside and yell at the sky. It is not a good use of your energy or your influence, right? So the first thing we do is we accept that it's raining or that it's stressful or whatever. And then what we do is we accept how we feel about it. So what we're trying to do is remove all resistance, because resistance is very stressful. It's very draining for us. So it's raining. We accept that. And also that we're frustrated by this, or it's not what we wanted. We're feeling disappointed, or whatever emotions come up around the circumstances that originally we were resisting. We accept those emotions as well. And what this does is that it allows us to soften a little bit. It allows us to really see what is happening for us. And so what we're doing is we're meeting life where it actually is and moving forward from there. So acceptance is not resignation. I'm not saying like lie down and cry. I'm saying accept the reality of the situation and move forward from there. For me, as a recovering perfectionist, overachieving type, this was revolutionary, because I was spinning my wheels and spending a lot of energy always trying to basically manipulate life to be how I thought I wanted it to be before I got there, right?
Yeah, right.
And then when it wasn't exactly the way I wanted it, I'd be really annoyed and frustrated and ticked off, right? And always trying to figure out how to make things how I wanted them. And life is wholly different. It feels completely different. I am free in a way that I never was when I just sort of accept that this is what's happening right now. And now, where will I have the most positive influence?
What do you think about resilience and grit and how those sometimes get misinterpreted, that I just need to have more grit, if you will, or the situation's bad, I just need to power through it, mm-hmm. and be more resilient, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's a misconception. I wonder how you think about this idea between resilience and grit.
Yeah, I think that the grit research, the literature around grit has really been manipulated away from the real kernels of truth. And if you look at Angela Duckworth's original research, you know, she really clearly defines grit as persistence plus passion. And what gets dropped is the passion piece of things, right? And so it just becomes about like, well, to be really resilient, what we need is to be really persistent. And that is a fast track to a heart attack. And so what we want is to be really resilient. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about seeing, you know, life's inevitable obstacles as necessary challenges, right? That there's actually some excitement in it. It's like, okay, well, this challenge is really going to teach me what I need to know to take it to the next level. Like that is a completely different emotional experience than I'm going to get the A. I'm going to get the promotion. I'm going to do what I think it's going to take to raise my status in some way. That feels heavy and hard. And what we know is that it doesn't lead to resilience.
So you've been a long-term researcher on happiness and how to cultivate happiness. What can you say about what conditions create a happy life?
Well, one main thing, if you remember only one thing from this podcast, it's that when we look at all the research on happiness in every field that has ever studied it, one major finding, I know you already know this, rises to the surface every time. And that is that a person's happiness is best predicted by both the breadth and the depth of their relationships to other people, their positive connections with other people. We human beings evolved in clans, and our nervous systems evolved to feel safe, to feel comfortable when we are a part of a social system. And I mean a real life, face-to-face social system. And so if we want to bring more joy into our lives, the most important thing that we can do is work on our relationships with other people. And it's not just the super tight, deep, intimate relationships with people. Those are very important. Also important is feeling connected to all the people that are around us so that we don't feel alone in a crowd. Our nervous system doesn't feel cut off from the people who are around us all the time. And that's fairly simple. It's just not easy if you have a smartphone in your hand, right? It's simple in that all you really need to do to signal a connection with another person, and what we're trying to do is signal to our own nervous system that we're connected, is make eye contact with them. Maybe smile, maybe chit-chat with them a little bit while you're waiting in line. So now you have lots of things to do while you're waiting in line. You can stare into space, you can daydream, or you can make eye contact with somebody, you can strike up a conversation with somebody. People always say, oh, that sounds horrible. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be the chatty person on the airplane. Well, guess what? We have research on this too. And while everybody thinks that they don't want to be next to somebody who's going to chat with them on the train or the airplane or waiting in line at Starbucks, they end up happier and they like it. So it works for us and it benefits the people that we're with as well.
What are some strategies you think about when you think about cultivating relationships to increase your sense of happiness at work? We're all surrounded by people at work, and oftentimes we just think of them, they're my colleague over here, they're my colleagues over here, it's people I just work with. How do you cultivate this sense of well-being and happiness by connecting with people at work on a level that does truly increase that sense of happiness?
Yeah, this is a hard thing to do when we're so stressed. So to remember that the chronic low levels of stress that we're all under make it really hard for us to connect with other people. We actually lose act to the part of our brain where we store subtle social information. So like remembering that the guy who works next to you has a dog named Bear can actually be a really sweet thing to ask him how his dog is. But when we're really stressed, we lose access to subtle things like that. So the first thing that we can do, of course, is to try and reduce our own stress. Beyond that, always thinking about what would bring happiness to other people, right? So when you go in thinking, I need to connect with you, that neediness, very unattractive. People don't like it, right? So, right? Yeah. But thinking like, what would make you happy? What can I do that would bring you joy? Because all I have to do is make you smile and because of our mirror neurons, there's a little part of my brain that thinks I'm actually smiling. It doesn't matter. The great benefit of positive connections with other people is it doesn't matter whether it's your happiness or their happiness. So just getting out of ourselves a little bit and really seeing the people that we're with. You know, people just want to be known. They just want to be seen. And so just asking people questions, just trying to see who they are is more than enough.
So Christine, is there anything else that when you think about life-work balance, especially in the context of the work part of it, that is important for people to know?
I think it's really important for people to look at the ways that they're already enough and to not believe the thoughts that they're having that they might not be doing well enough. You know, I see people all the time who say to me, I feel like I'm not doing well enough at home. I'm not doing well enough at work. And what that does is it puts you into a scarcity mindset where then all you see is stress. All you see are the ways that you're falling short. And your brain actually loses the ability to see where you're already enough, where you're doing fine. And so, you know, those thoughts that you're not enough are not true, probably. So don't believe them all the time. When they come up, look to what might be as true or truer, which is all the places that you're doing great, that you're enough.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.